Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Centre here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan US Centre's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. In June 2024, the LSE Phelan US Centre hosted the conference US Nuclear Strategy in a Changing Indo-Pacific. The conference brought together scholars and analysts with a strong record of policy-relevant research on nuclear strategy and expertise in the security dynamics of the Indo-Pacific. The conference was convened by Phelan US Centre affiliates Rohan Mukherjee and Lauren Sukin, both assistant professors of international relations in the LSE's International Relations Department. I spoke to Lauren Sukin about the main themes and takeaways from the conference and what it was trying to achieve.
Thank you so much for joining us on The Ballpark today. It's great to be able to speak to you. Just to start us off, could you please just introduce yourself and tell our listeners a bit about your current research and work? Thank you so much.
So I'm Lauren Sukin. I'm an assistant professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. I'm a scholar of international security, and in particular, my work focuses on nuclear weapons. I like to think of my work about nuclear alliance politics. So how do states with nuclear weapons interact with allies and partners that don't have those same capabilities? My research tends to focus on examining those alliances in two geopolitical contexts in the Indo-Pacific, as well as in Europe, really focusing on the intra-alliance politics of NATO and how those affect nuclear deterrence and reassurance between nuclear allies. The conference that we ran at LSE on June 7th dealt with some of these themes, thinking about the alliances between the United States and its non-nuclear partners in the Asia-Pacific region.
So as you said, on the 7th of June 2024, you convened the conference US Nuclear Strategy in a Changing Indo-Pacific here at LSE. Can you talk a bit about why the conference was timely, what it achieved, and what it hopes to achieve?
One of the things that's fundamentally changed in international security and in nuclear politics in particular is a new salience of nuclear threats in the world. And there are multiple components of this. One, of course, is the resurgence of nuclear threats from Russia with the Russo-Ukrainian war. And we've seen a lot of nuclear saber rattling that has reinvigorated conversation around what it means to have a nuclear arsenal and how that might shape politics and international security. But Russia is only one part of the equation. In the Indo-Pacific region, we've seen countries increase the size of their nuclear arsenals and recenter nuclear weapons as a critical component of their foreign and security policy. We can see this in India and Pakistan, where we continue to see small increases in the size of these countries' nuclear arsenals and a series of close misses or near accidents that might make us worried about what happens if a nuclear incident spirals out of control. With North Korea, we've seen not only a new focus on nuclear weapons as an intractable component of the regime's foreign policy, but a massive increase in the number of nuclear weapons that the regime is aiming for and the testing of nuclear-adjacent capabilities, such as long-range ballistic missiles. North Korea has tested more of these missiles in the last couple of years than they have in their whole history prior to 2022. And in China, we've seen a substantial increase in Chinese nuclear capabilities, with mini weapons being developed and hundreds of new missile silos being constructed. U.S. government estimates suggest that in just a handful of years, the Chinese nuclear arsenal could potentially be as large as the number of deployed weapons that the United States has. So these fundamental changes that we're seeing in geopolitics suggest that we might need to rethink nuclear strategy in the face of growing threats from adversaries and new possibilities for miscommunication and accidents in the nuclear realm. The conference took this development as a starting point and tried to look at discrete regions of the world that may have to deal with new challenges coming out of this nuclear insecurity in the Indo-Pacific region. The conference brought together scholars to talk about China's nuclear developments, nuclear risks on the Korean Peninsula, nuclear dangers in South Asia, as well as to think about how the United States and Europe were responding to those changes and threats. So the conversation helped us to address some of these emerging concerns and help develop a framework for learning about nuclear politics across regions and alliance networks.
Thank you so much for that. So you've talked about thinking about a framework for looking at these kind of issues in the regions you talked about. Can you talk a bit about the main themes and takeaways from the conference as it happened? Thank you.
One of the things that we often see in nuclear scholarship is a real emphasis on capabilities, who has what. And this is only part of the equation. Many of the aspects that come out of this conference emphasize the politics, the small p politics of nuclear security. So, for example, Nicola Leveringhouse, one of our excellent colleagues at King's, wrote a paper talking about how internal politics in China has affected the new Chinese nuclear developments. And she demonstrates that changes in the bureaucracy and changes in the CCP's imagination of the role of nuclear weapons in their military strategy give us really valuable insights into understanding why and how China's rebuilding their nuclear capabilities. So Debak Das wrote a paper for us about nuclear politics between India and Pakistan and emphasized in particular how India has a unique problem of trying to respond to multiple nuclear adversaries. It not only has to prepare its nuclear strategy in response to the anticipation of how Pakistan might think about nuclear politics, but also is responding to Chinese nuclear developments. And what this gives us is a sort of spiral of nuclear development. U.S. policy affects China's perceptions of its security, and Chinese policy then spirals to affect Indian policy, and Indian policy might affect policy in Pakistan. It shows us that these capability developments are not independent, but are interdependent and are related to how countries in sequence might think of their position in the world.
So you've mentioned some of the presenters and some of the talks. What were some of the highlights you found from the talks that were presented?
The talks provided us with new and valuable perspectives on critical issues in nuclear security. So, for example, one of the issues that translates across geopolitical regions is a renewed conversation about the value of the United States stationing its nuclear weapons abroad. So while Europe is having conversations about expanding the nuclear mission of NATO, perhaps even adding new states to the DCA mission, such as Poland or perhaps Sweden, the same conversations are happening in the Indo-Pacific region as South Korea struggles to address the direct nuclear threat it faces from Russia, and some policymakers in the country have advocated that the U.S. return nuclear weapons to the peninsula in order to strengthen South Korea's nuclear deterrent. These conversations can learn from each other. So the ability we had at this conference to both talk about the history and modern politics of nuclear sharing in Europe and the history and politics of nuclear sharing in the Indo-Pacific highlights some of those cross-regional lessons that might help us develop nuclear strategy and posture in a more comprehensive way. Similarly, we were able to highlight how the United States is responding to these developments and to think not just about the U.S. bilateral relationships with its key allies under the nuclear security umbrella, but how broad elements of U.S. posture might affect the positions of its allies and partners. So, for example, we spoke with Luis Rodriguez about the United States' security policy in Latin America and highlighted elements of geopolitical competition between U.S. and Chinese influence in the region that could potentially have implications for security and even nuclear security down the line. In this way, one of the critical highlights of the conference was the ability to identify large areas of U.S. policy that might need updating or new understandings in an age of evolving nuclear security concerns.
So based on what you spoke about in the conference, would you say that the United States needs to think more about its nuclear policy in the Indo-Pacific region?
One of the challenges the United States is facing is what some experts have called the two-peer nuclear problem. The U.S. has a nuclear posture that for quite a long time has been primarily oriented towards deterring threats from the Soviet Union and then Russia. But today, nuclear strategy has to do much more than that. The United States has to not only protect allies from Russian threats, but also has to deal with an increased nuclear threat coming from China, the risk of concurrent conflict in multiple regions, and smaller nuclear adversaries like North Korea, as well as potential proliferation risks, including Iran. The U.S. has tried to adopt a nuclear strategy that answers some of these questions in international politics. Elements of tailored deterrence or integrated deterrence try to get at these aspects. How can the U.S. use its full portfolio of resources to address different types of challenges in different areas? One of the things we talked about in this conference was how the United States needs to be aware of some of the dangers of its current approach. For example, U.S. Policymakers in the past week have announced that the United States could consider additional contributions to the nuclear arsenal if China and Russia continue the sorts of policy developments that we've seen from them in the past year or so. But our conference highlighted some of the risks that would come if the United States takes this more hardline approach of building new nuclear delivery vehicles or other capacities, that these could challenge China's ideas of trying to achieve some sort of stable balance. It could make it harder to reach arms control agreements or potentially cause spiraling effects in India and other nations, as we discussed earlier. And so it's not that the United States is not taking these nuclear threats seriously, but that many of the scholars in our conversation emphasized that the traditional approach the United States has taken to these nuclear problems of more is always better may not be the best way forward in this interconnected nuclear world.
Thank you so much for that. And just before we finish, is there any new work or any projects you're working on you'd like to direct our audience to?
I might point the audience to two recent papers that deal with some of these topics. So in one project, myself, along with one of our conference participants and an LSE graduate student, Wuyok Seo, recently wrote for the Journal of Peace and Nuclear Disarmament. In this piece, we used surveys conducted in South Korea, Japan, Indonesia, Taiwan, and Australia to examine attitudes about the nuclear alliance with the United States and nuclear threat issues, including nuclear proliferation. We find substantial support for nuclear proliferation in South Korea, as previous surveys have found, but also show interest in nuclear proliferation in Taiwan and Indonesia, where less work has examined public attitudes about nuclear risks. We show in this paper that the publics in these countries are really concerned about the intensity of nuclear risks that they face, but also have substantial worries about the quality of their alliance with the United States and may need to reevaluate some of the elements of their nuclear alliances if these security risks become more pressing.
Thank you so much for that. We'll link to that in the show notes as well. Professor Lauren Sukin, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark.
Thank you.
Lauren Sukin is Assistant Professor of International Relations in the LSE's International Relations Department and co-convener of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy in a Changing Indo-Pacific Conference. During the conference, I spoke to three of the participants about their thoughts on the nuclear security dynamics of their areas. Deepak Das is an Assistant Professor at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. Matthew Furman is a Professor of Political Science and Presidential Impact Fellow at Texas A&M University. And J. Lewis Rodriguez is an assistant professor of international security and law at George Mason University's Schar School for Policy and Government. I asked each of the three participants about what they saw as the nuclear security dynamics in their region of focus and how the U.S. has been responding to these, both within that region and across the Indo-Pacific.
So my name is Deepak Das, and I'm an assistant professor at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. Thanks a lot. That's a very important question. There are a couple of things that I think about when I'm thinking about nuclear security dynamics in South Asia. One is, of course, the India-Pakistan dynamic, and then the second is the India-China dynamic. With the India-Pakistan dynamic, what you see is a sort of stability today. Both sides have matured into understanding how the other side responds to nuclear modernization. So you've got India today sort of thinking about its relationship with Pakistan in terms of a conventional war. You see today India trying to create a little bit more space for conventional escalation with Pakistan, because thus far Pakistan has had something called a full spectrum deterrence posture, which means that it has threatened to use nuclear weapons in response to Indian conventional forces. India has sort of called that bluff, especially after 2019, when we had the Balakot strike in Pakistan as in response to a terrorist attack in Pulwama. And so today we are at a stage where both sides are sort of stable, but also concerned that the other side might escalate. In terms of the India-China relationship, this one is, I think, one that India is more focused on today, especially after 2020 when the Galwan Valley crisis took place. What we see over there is that India has now tried to set up new forces, new rocket forces, something called the Integrated Rocket Forces, in an attempt to try and create a space where it can potentially escalate at a conventional level against China in response to Chinese incursions onto the Indian side along the line of actual control. This would create a situation where India can conduct standoff strikes, potentially conventional escalation, without ever going up to the nuclear level. India and China both have nuclear no first use policies, so that would create some form of strategic stability at the nuclear level, allowing India and China to escalate at the conventional, or at least fight some form of conventional war. So that's those are India and Pakistan and China and India. The other thing to think about in this sort of context and region is the role of the United States, right? And here, I think we need to be thinking about the Indo-Pacific. And there is something I called a cascade of competition, which is happening in the broader region. So the United States is responding to China's new nuclear weapon silos, missile modernization, and China is responding to the fact that the United States has a nuclear complex with at least 3,600 nuclear weapons, which is looking to expand and modernize. So you've got the US modernizing, expanding. You've got China modernizing, expanding in response to the United States. You've got India looking at China and thinking, well, we don't want to be too far asymmetric or too far down in the nuclear asymmetry with China. So India is modernizing in response, or it's likely to modernize in response. And then you've got Pakistan thinking, well, we don't want to fall too far behind India. So you've got Pakistan also trying to respond to Indian nuclear modernization and building of rocket forces and missile forces. So really what you see are downstream effects of US nuclear strategy in some ways affecting different nuclear dyads as well as regional proliferation.
That was Deepak Das at the University of Denver.
Matt Furman from Texas A&M University. The United States is worried about multiple challenges in the Indo-Pacific. It's worried about China's growing nuclear capabilities and what it might need to do to respond in that vein. Meanwhile, there is renewed concerns about North Korea's capabilities, given its nuclear expansion as well, and what dynamics that's going to have for the alliance that the United States has with South Korea. So there are a number of interwoven challenges in the region right now that the United States is trying to manage. Meanwhile, Washington would like to engage on the arms control question with both Russia and China. Neither of those states, though, has shown much interest right now in being willing to do that. China, in part because its nuclear capabilities in terms of numbers are much lower than what the United States and Russia currently possesses. Russia is not interested, in large part because of the political dynamics right now in terms of the relationship between the United States and Russia, given the war in Ukraine. So although the United States has said that it will negotiate on arms control with Russia without preconditions and would like to bring in China to these discussions as well, the prospects for any deal in the short term seem pretty bleak right now, given the overall political relationship. So because of that, there's concerns about increase in nuclear capabilities, not only in the Indo-Pacific, but potentially globally, and what implications that might have for future nuclear proliferation in a country like South Korea, where there are increasing concerns about the security situation in the Korean Peninsula, North Korea's growing capabilities, and whether South Korea can trust the United States to intervene on its behalf in the event that it faces a severe security crisis from North Korea. So a number of security concerns right now in the Indo-Pacific that are requiring deep thought in Washington and elsewhere. The political dynamics in the U.S., I think, are really critical for understanding future challenges in the Indo-Pacific, in large part because one thing that plays a critical role in the region, in my view, is the alliances that the United States maintains with critical countries like South Korea and Japan. And if the presidential election in the United States results in Donald Trump coming to power, there are real questions about what that would do to the strength of these alliances. On a number of occasions, Trump and others aligned with him have raised questions about whether the U.S. would really intervene to support countries like South Korea. And so there's real concern that these alliance relationships might not remain robust after the presidential election in the United States. And one consequence of that is that countries like South Korea, Japan, potentially others, are thinking about what they need to do with respect to their security in the event that the relationship with the United States weakens. Some might fear that if they can't trust the United States to provide for their security, they might have to become more self-reliant. That could include potentially movement towards an indigenous nuclear weapons capability in a place like South Korea. So certainly U.S. domestic politics are carrying significant implications for what's going on in the region.
That was Matthew Furman of Texas A&M University.
My name is Luis Rodriguez, and I'm at the Shire School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Yeah, so Latin American countries have tried to stay out of nuclear security conflicts and away from great power competitions, especially in the Indo-Pacific. In terms of nuclear security, Latin America has an approach that promotes its freedom from fear. In the 1960s, these countries established the first nuclear weapon-free zone in a densely populated area, and the only one with negative security assurances, effectively promoting nuclear stability. And most countries in the region support, and some even lead, the international effort to ban nuclear arsenals. They argue that nuclear weapons are the primary source of nuclear risks and insecurity, so these countries believe that banning these arsenals, whether regionally or internationally, is the most effective strategy for reducing nuclear risks. At the same time, these countries are attentive to the nuclear dynamics in the Indo-Pacific. Brazil, for example, closely follows the cooperation that Australia, the US, and the UK started in 2021 to share technology for nuclear-powered submarines. And in 2022, Brazil started conversations with the International Atomic Energy Agency on using nuclear material under safeguards in nuclear propulsion. In terms of the Indo-Pacific more generally, Latin America is a fence sitter. Latin American countries have tried to avoid taking sides in potential great power conflicts, while at the same time attempting to reap the benefits of these multiple relationships. Non-alignment and hedging have proved successful thus far. These countries have increased their trade with countries in the Indo-Pacific, primarily with China and to a lesser degree with India, while deepening security cooperation with the United States. And let me finish by saying that Latin American countries have different strategies alliances, and even interests, especially when it comes to security dynamics. And the United States has to understand these varied approaches to managing conflicts in the region, especially the different approaches that these countries have to reducing nuclear risks. I think that this is a much better strategy than just treating all of them with a one-size-fits-all kind of approach to dealing or talking with Latin American countries. U.S. officials have tried to improve the United States' relationship with Latin America by investing in technological cooperation, freedom of navigation, and managing nuclear proliferation risks. For instance, the United States co-hosted the first Western Hemisphere Nuclear Risk Reduction Workshop together with Mexico in the United Nations headquarters in New York in April 2024. This is the first time that the U.S. has done this after all of these years. And while these are steps in the right direction, the United States needs to invest more significantly in these relationships, understanding Latin American preferences and aligning interests. Because I argue that the U.S. and these countries don't have automatic alignments. The U.S. needs to forge these relationships.
That was J. Lewis Rodriguez of George Mason University. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Lauren Sukin, Deepak Das, Matthew Fremen, and J. Lewis Rodriguez for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Center and our work, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On Twitter and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on Facebook, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Anderson Tan. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.